talking about, and also someone who lived and died with a living memory of most of us. Since I think his memory, he died in 1988, and had a very long ministry as Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, the books I've been working on have been Owen Chadwick's biography of him, Michael Ramsey, who was a friend and scholar. And this book, Michael Ramsey, a portrait by Michael de la Noy, who was Ramsey's press officer. Whereas the other one is objective and scholarly, but also the work of a friend, this work is bitchy, prejudiced, but also it's an inside view of what was going on at Lambeth, not without the occasional penetrating insight and inside a goblet of information you won't get any other way. Michael Ramsey was born in 1904 to a mathematics don of Magdalen College. Remember, Magdalen College is where Rowan Williams has gone to be the master right now. Arthur Ramsey, who was the son of a Congregationalist minister whose father had served a chapel in Dewsbury. Let's remember, that's where Austin Farrer had been the curate himself in the west, south of the West Riding, Yorkshire. So he was raised in a devout, somewhat austere Congregationalist family. His mother, Agnes, was a child of the vicarage, a socialist, a suffragist, with a lively social conscience, politically alive, who brought progressive politicians into the house, and she was a good speaker on public platforms. She had a powerful sense of humour, she was a good conversationalist and a magnetic personality, undoubtedly the dominant personality in Michael's childhood, or Mick as he was known to his siblings. He had a it was a rather grim house without beauty or comfort. An overworking father determined to make the family financially secure was not often present. Ironically, the house has now been, and its orchard was sold to the English Dominicans, have now turned into Blackfriars, their monastic establishment in Cambridge. Yes, I went to a seminar there. They have a monthly sort of house group meeting, the meal, I think, great. His siblings, he had an older brother called Frank, and two or three sisters, found Michael odd, a loner difficult to relate to in a normal, friendly way, physically clumsy, especially in the management of his hands, much given grimacing and pulling of faces. In the night, he could be heard running up and down his attic bedroom, banging the wall at each end and keeping people awake. He felt himself to be a backward boy, overshadowed by his brilliant brother, Frank. He was sent to some dame schools. His mother tried homeschooling him. He hated that because he loved her and he just got bored with the whole thing. So he was sent to King's College Choir School, which accepts not just boys into the choir of King's College, Cambridge. And so his serious education begins here. Here he meets the first Anglican priest interested in religion, Eric Milner White, who's the chaplain of King's College, who teaches divinity to the day boys, a charming young man of rather Anglo-Catholic opinions, inventor of the service of nine lessons and carols. You know, we think that this service has been around for centuries. It ain't. It's an early 20th century innovation. This man will crop up again in Ramsey's life, and Ramsey kept a photograph of him on the wall right up to the day of his death. One is that he made divinity fun, even though it was taught before breakfast. He was sent to a boarding school in Surrey when he was desperately homesick, and wrote to his mother to ask him to be taken away. One of his uncles came to him, visited him, and said, if he ever wrote a letter like that again, he'd thrash him. So he stopped complaining. So he was sent in 1918 to this school, Repton, where the headmaster was Geoffrey Fisher, a man who would play a much larger role in his life than most headmasters. This is what Fisher looked like as headmaster of Repton in the interwar years. Quick, affable, capable, always saw straight to the point of an argument. Ramsey regarded Fisher as distant, but forceful and rapid and efficient, a gifted teacher of Latin and Greek, who taught with enthusiasm and humour. Now, Fisher, Roald Dahl, a famous writer of children's stories, presented a caricature view of Fisher as a savage disciplinarian, which is felt by many of those who went to Repton to be deeply unfair and untrue. And let's remember that Roald Dahl's children's stories are deeply cruel stories themselves if you look at them. And he was a very strange man himself. Now, I'm going to talk a bit about this relationship and how it played out. Ramsey was regarded as an oddity at school, who preferred the library to games and sport, but emerges later in a happier phase because he's got a real talent for debating. And Fisher's final report on Randi says, a boy with plenty of force of character who, in spite of certain uncouthnesses, has done good service on his own lines. This was quoted often by Ramsay later on, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, we're going to hear later on about how Fisher tried to spike Ramsay's guns in becoming Archbishop of Canterbury. But the problem was that there are an absolute contrast in personality. Fisher's a great administrator, immense capacity for working long hours, very shrewd about people, all the things that Ramsay's not so good at. And Ramsay really felt overshadowed all his life. So later on, when he was Archbishop of Canterbury or Bishop of Durham, Fisher would call him Michael, but he never felt able to call him Geoffrey back again. There was always a kind of sense of being overshadowed by him. And their paths will cross again and again. On holiday, he discovers his much-admired old brother, Frank, is an atheist and resolves to practice his religion better. Having to hold his ground against his clever brother's arguments matures his religion. He liked the Book of Common Prayer as opposed to congregational worship and was confirmed at Repton. Already interested in Anglo-Catholicism, he reads a bizarre book from the Protestant underworld, Walsh's Secret History of the Oxford Movement. The boy saw through the fanaticism and found a sense of chivalry was excited. One of the nastiest of the pseudo-religious books of the Victorian age helped to condition the impressionable mind of a future Christian leader of the next century. He wins a scholarship to study classics at his father's college, Magdalen. He did not find it awkward that his father was a tutor there. He's now a leading debater and very popular at Cambridge. Tempted to become a liberal politician to share in his mother's politics, and he spoke persuasively on behalf of the party, and the party was keen to recruit him as a future MP. He finds a home in the Anglo-Catholicism of St. Giles, Cambridge. Now, this church is just across the river from Magdalen College, about 3 minutes' walk from it. The great sadness is that the vicar and most of the congregation decamped to Rome recently over the ordination of women. Just a rump core has been left now under the leadership of a woman priest who's trying to hold together the small core of people there. He came to bed at the 11 o'clock non-communicating high mass because he felt that the mind was left free for pondering and adoring. Later on, as Bishop of Durham, he expresses reservations about the fact that the parish communion movement is axing morning services and axing the 11 o'clock non-communicating high mass and trying to get everybody to go to that service to communicate often and often to lower the sense of reverence and devotion accompanying these other services. He now came to believe that churches could do more for people than political parties because they were engaged at a more profound level with the predicament of humanity. In his third year, he made his first confession. In 1926, there's a major mission to Cambridge University, and it's a real catalyzer for Ramsay. They pick three missioners, a popular nonconformist preacher from London, the famous William Temple comes, and a Northern Irish evangelist, who was a combination of crude fundamentalism, vulgarity, rudeness, and emotional appeals, and a dogmatism so dogmatic as to frighten many, made a profound impression on Ramsay and inculcated a lifelong dislike of extreme evangelical methods of evangelism, which later complicated things, of course, because Billy Graham would come to Britain in the 50s and 60s in the heyday of his ministry, and Ramsay's critical comments about his crusades, missions, would get him into trouble. He is impressed by William Temple's confronting of the life of the real world and all its complexities and his care for the intellectual questions in religious life. Throughout his life, he never lost his admiration for the mind, character, and warmth and friendliness of Temple, another of the decisive influences on him. His last 14 months at Cambridge, he changes to the study of theology and studies intensively, coming under the influence of Edwin Hoskins, who unfortunately we couldn't find a photograph of, the Dean of Corpus Christi, the only Anglo-Catholic on the Divinity Faculty. Now, theology in Britain in the interwar years is dominated by modernists and liberals. The great teacher there at Cambridge was Bethune Baker, known as the Bath Bum by students. Unfortunately, the image we had of him won't show on this, on his books. And what Hoskin stands for, he's read Karl Barth, and he introduces Barthian thought into English theology, which has always been insular, always complacent, and always suspicious of European influences in theology. And let's remember that what Karl Barth stands for is a rejection of the complacent assumptions of liberal Protestant thought in the period leading up to the First World War. So Hoskins is another major influence on his life. Oh, is he just still going? So I need to press the buttons for him and clattering, doesn't he? At the end of the 14 months, Ramsay goes to Cuddesdon, a theological college we had come across before in connection with Austin Farrer, and spends four terms there. And this ought to have been an opportunity to rest and consolidate all his learning and to quietly pray. But a great trauma comes into his life. His father acquired a car recently, and he didn't have to have a driver's license in the interwar period. And although they were only motoring along at 25 to 30 miles an hour, in an act of carelessness, the car went off the road, crashed into a roller over, and killed both Agnes Ramsay and one of the passengers in the back seat. And this absolutely devastated Ramsay, and he spent most of those four terms trying to come to terms with it. What is it Michael Delannoy says? Agnes may not have found it easy to show Michael maternal affection. He was a shy, awkward boy, desperate for love, but unable physically to respond. Nevertheless, much of his personality was moulded on hers, and what warmth and genuine humanity had flowed through the chill rooms of Howfield could be provided by her. Instead of weeping and openly showing his grief, he bottled it up, and from then on found it difficult to identify with the suffering of other people at a deep and personal level. He becomes withdrawn, even more eccentric in his behaviour, and goes into psychoanalysis. Very popular in those days, to deal with him and in conflicts. We now have the basic ingredients of Michael Ramsay's mind, a non-conformist origin, a discovery of Anglo-Catholicism and its devotional power, originally through its fanatical critics, and then fostered by wise friends. The admiration for the mind and personality of William Temple, a desire to understand the thought and experience of the Apostolic Church, a suspicion of the normal liberal interpretation of the evidence about the Apostolic Church among the leading English thinkers of the day were clever and persuasive and yet were open to the charges of superficiality. An openness of mind to the European reaction against liberal Protestantism represented especially by Karl Barth, and a belief that the Church, if it could get its message right, could do more than the lawyers or the economists or the political leaders, for it being the chief hope for society in the world. All these constituents needed fusing and moulding into a unity in his mind. He thought and meditated, filled them out by experience and pastoral care and by writing, and came to such a unity in all his later life. He had a coherence of outlook and thought and devotion and ethic which was an anchor to the Church of England in difficult days. Such a fusion and coherence of mind entailed certain rejections. He rejected fundamentalist ideas of the biblical evidence. History was history, and minds must be free. He rejected hot methods of evangelism by mission and believed that quiet, rational exposition was the true Christian way, even if its results were not spectacular. He suspected the dominant divinity of shallowness and undue optimism. Though deeply Anglo-Catholic, he rejected what the world thought of as Anglo-Catholic fuss, the mistaking of the right vestment for the right religion. So he's ordained in 1929 to be the curate of Liverpool, St. Nicholas Liverpool. Now, Liverpool's a diocese that comes into existence in the 19th century, and Disraeli's then the Prime Minister. That's where he's a Jew who's converted to the Church of England, and he shares Queen Victoria's low church opinions, and he makes jolly sure that the first bishops of Liverpool are evangelic, which has set the tone for the diocese of Liverpool ever since. And it's remembered that Gladstone is his chief political rival, and when he gets into power, and he's also very involved in the Church of England, even more so, and gets, the way you influence things was to gain control of the patronage of parishes. He made sure that St. Nicholas would be staffed by Anglo-Catholics thereafter as a counterblast to what Disraeli had done in setting the tone for the Diocese of Liverpool. Now, this was a dockside parish full of poor parishioners, poor stevedores, and a few of them came to the church. A lot of people came across to Mersey from Birkenhead or from various parts of the city.
So there weren't any Anglo-Catholic parishes in Liverpool?
No, there are some though. Amazing, very good ones. Yeah. In Miracle of Father Carl, the gas industry. That's a forceful one. Come to Liverpool. Ramsay was not the noisy, breezy curate the rector wanted to get at his rough teenagers. But he was liked by the parishioners. He said, as a curate, I was never frightened of visiting. I never minded being shy. I was content to be shy. I perplexed other people. I was content to be silent. He was safe, isolation of mind, by Canon Charles Raven, a fiery, charismatic man with a large heart. At Liverpool, he turned himself into the most powerful preacher in England. And he's one of the most foremost exponents of liberal divinity in the Church of England in the interwar years.
Charismatic in what sense?
Not in the neo-revival sense. I mean, he was a major personality, yes. He was an utter contrast to Ramsay, a low church man versus a high churchman, a philosopher of religion and science versus an inquiring conservative, a suspecter of orthodoxy versus a young man who saw the stature of the Catholic tradition. But he cared passionately about things of the mind. He was forward in seeking out young people of promise and giving them encouragement. Ramsay joins Raven's New Testament class as pushed hard in provocative debate. Already he knew in his heart that to be a vicar or a curate was not his vocation as a priest for the rest of his life. And along comes the second great bereavement of his life, the death of his brother Frank. Now, we have to understand, whereas Ramsay was bright, Frank was a genius. As an undergraduate, he translated from the German Wittgenstein's Tractatus, which many people have read and never understood. He would have gone on, had he lived, to be one of the foremost shapers of mathematical exploration, research and development in the 20th century. And quite a contrast to his brother Michael. He married young and lived a bohemian lifestyle. He and his wife had an open marriage. There's an extraordinary photograph in this book, the Chadwick book, of Frank walking down by the Cam with his mistress on one side and his wife on the other. They all knew what was going on. But the point is that for all the fact that Frank gave him a hard time as a modern atheist, he loved Frank and had the utmost respect for him. And Frank died of a liver complaint. He suffered from jaundice all through his childhood and turned nasty and died quite quickly. So Ramsay always finds it very hard adult-like to talk about this. But before he died, Frank's dismissal of religion was no longer contemptuous, and he inquired of Michael about religious experience, what goes on in people when they do have that. Michael Ramsay took Frank's funeral, and at the end of the service, which was in a crematorium, it was noted that his face was contorted with grief and he practically ran out of the chapel. In later life, he surprised guardians of Catholic orthodoxy by saying he expected to meet atheists in heaven. He then becomes, in that same year, subwarden of Lincoln Theological College, now closed, around 40 students, mostly not from universities. He gave a lot of lectures because in theological colleges the staff are few and the ground to be covered is enormous, so the staff are always racing to keep ahead of the students and write the lectures just one step ahead of them. The students remembered him as a man with a sharp sense of the ridiculous, who ragged them but was too shy to be intimate with them, but they liked him much for his friendliness and humour. Who was famous for long, sudden, and embarrassing silences. Who was so eccentric that none of them believed he would later be a man of distinction. A man who loved theology and who believed it to be the highest intellectual activity for humanity. A fierce defender of liberty of opinion for Marxists as for anyone else. But who gave the impression of being an exceptional person. He disturbed other people's prayers and chapel with convulsive fidgets and sudden face rubbings. Who had a manifest and rare mystical sense of the immediate presence of God. Presence so immediate that it could most overpower. He's becoming known in this period that invitations to preach are coming in. Now, see, this is another thing to understand about Michael Ramsay. He was bizarre. If you heard the local vicar was behaving like this, he would tend to write him off. And despite all of these things, the complete lack of small talk, the extraordinary grimacing and facial expressions, the whistling in processions, the difficulty of presenting himself with clean clothes, he is this kind of figure of deep spirituality and commands people's respect. In these years, he writes the first of his great books, The Gospel and the Catholic Church, which has been deeply influenced by the Barkianism of the Edward Hoskins. He argued that the church should not dilute itself or adjust itself to what contemporary Smith or Jones can swallow. It cannot convert the gospel into social reform. He cried out for the church to be itself, to know that its being rests upon a death and an empty tomb, and to be itself where the modern Britain will listen or close its ears. It was an effort to fuse the Protestant idea with the Catholic idea as they were fused within his personal history. He would show the Catholic that the church is nothing without the word spoken of the crucifixion. He would show the Protestant that the church, with its order and structure and mission, is a necessary part of the word spoken in the crucifixion. The book is full of the Bible, its essay and church order, a book which gets him further noticed. Here is a young man learned in the New Testament and in the early fathers, thinking hard for himself, manifestly a lover of God and of the gospel, an Anglo-Catholic, but one who spoke in tones more persuasive to Protestants than was usual among Anglo-Catholics, with tolerance and respect and a gratitude for all that was best in the Protestant tradition. The book's an enduring masterpiece, but it causes a breach with those of liberal or modernist theological opinion, and it causes a breach with Raven, because there's a small attack on him, but also because Raven regards the eruption of Barthian thought into English theology as deeply unacceptable, a poisoning of the well. Now, he gave the invitation, the cathedral's right next to this place, the great, you know, west face of the cathedral, and he gave a series of addresses at the cathedral, and the bishop came up to him afterwards and said, "Look, I just couldn't understand what you're talking about. I think you need more exposure to ordinary people so that you can preach properly and teach to ordinary people. What you need is a second curacy, and I've got just the curacy for you. I want you to go to Boston Stump Parish Church." And so, and Ramsay agreed. And it was felt by some to be the only strange decision of his life. By now, he's been asked to take retreats, to preach all over the place. But his fellow curates sort of his deeply desire, he whistled while he was walking in processions of church. His deep shyness and strangeness continued. He was staying with a landlady, and one time he forgot his keys, went back and knocked on the door, and she said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Ramsay is out," which Ramsay replied, "I'll call back later." Well, he's rescued from the strange, I think, by becoming the vicar of St. Bennet's in Cambridge. Now, St. Bennet's is a very small church right in the middle of Cambridge. It's got very small, almost no parish at all. You don't have to worry about all the things the vicar usually has to worry about. Silver's just had a brilliant ministry there as a preacher and confessor. The divinity faculty tends to worship there, but he stayed there only about a year. His father appreciated the chance to go to church to hear his son preach. He becomes professor of divinity at Durham and a canon of the cathedral. And perhaps the most decisive person in his life comes into it now when he meets Joan Hamilton, who's secretary and chauffeur to the Bishop of Jarrow, and he marries her in 1942. He was open-hearted, smiling, caring, and changed his life. The cold, vast house they lived in became warm and atmosphere and hospitable. She helped to create for him a widening circle of friends. She made him less formidable. It was a childless marriage. I'm sorry, we just couldn't find a photograph of him, which is odd, because the book's full of them, but we just couldn't find any on the web. Ramsay revitalizes the theology department to become the most respected of English universities, a preacher in demand across Durham County. He thinks that a lot of residential living is of high importance in a university, for he believed that the object of higher education was not just information or preparation for a career, but a community of minds and personalities. Quote, "It is not difficult to produce sophisticated men and women by collecting them to learn certain subjects, but it's not sophisticated men and women that a good university tries to produce. It's men and women whose knowledge goes with character and with reverence for persons and for the things of the mind." What Harley would make of that. Now, in this time, he publishes a book, The Resurrection, not one of his greatest ones, but then he writes this, one of the great books on the Transfiguration, about glory, which is one of his favourite subjects. His books always tend to be short, very biblical. They're not philosophical at all, but they've got a real Eastern Orthodox tinge to them in their conclusions. Then he produces in 1949 a book about Frederick Denison Morris and other of his heroes. He's now very involved in committees of the ecumenical movement, a rising tide of Christian hope. You know, Adolf Hitler helped to revitalize Christianity after all. People had thought they peered over the abyss into human horror and evil. And produced, remember we learned last week in Austin Farris' time, a revival of religion amongst undergraduates. But the ecumenical movement, which before the war had been seen as the product of a few specialists, dull clergy, speaking wise words into one of the waistcoats, as somebody put it, now becomes a major force, and this is finally beginning the World Council of Churches. He makes an outstanding contribution at the first meeting of the World Council of Churches in 1948 in Amsterdam, where the star performers are Karl Barth, George Borowski of the Eastern Orthodox Church, and Ramsey. Ramsey's no longer a Barthian. He clashes often with Karl Barth, but someone he shared a common sense of humour with. When Barth went home, he described Ramsey on return to his family as my very good neighbour, Canon Ramsey from Durham, an authentic Anglo-Catholic with strange views concerning tradition, succession, ontology, and so on, but also with a very convincing twinkle in his eye, a man with whom I more often agreed than disagreed, the outstanding figure in the picture of my first ecumenical experience. Now, Ramsey now begins to doubt this style of ecumenical meeting. You know, so many people there, you can't get to know them all. Many people haven't done any work before they turned up. What a grandstanding going on. And he wanted to get clarity for the Damas debate. And all these suspicions hardened into firm certainties at the second great meeting of the World Council of Churches at Evanston in the United States in 1954, which he found a deeply discouraging experience. In 1950, he becomes a Regius Professor of Divinity at Cambridge, despite the opposition of a number of modernist theologians at Cambridge, including Charles Raven, who's now retired. Again, he revitalised the department. But in 1952, he's appointed to be the Bishop of Durham. Unusual that he was allowed only 20 months in the Cambridge job, and is already perceived as a likely Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, this is of the great Auckland, Bishops of Auckland, who was he said this was the hardest decision of his life, but he decided that the bench of bishops needed a bishop who's an apostolic teacher whose vocation is to guard the faith, to present it, to expound it. See, that's what Anglicans believe, the apostolic paradigm. That's what bishops are there to do, not to be political wheeler dealers, not to be great administrators, to teach the faith, to preserve the faith. Both the Ramseys loved living in Auckland Castle, a historic pile eminent in the history of England and of the church, with magnificent memorials of celebrated prelates of past centuries. I have never lived in a place where the past was so alive and my great predecessors seemed like daily companions. Ramsey felt the same ecstasy of history speaking out of sanctified stones in Durham itself. He found that in such a place, present was near to past and visible near to the invisible world. He concentrated in these years on getting to know his clergy and people. The most unhappy thing, this was his most happy episcopate. He and Jones loved being there in the north. There was one very unhappy thing, though. The most Anglo-Catholic parish in the diocese of St. Mary's Tyne Dock in South Shields, the vicar had made certain innovations for that faculty, quite a few innovations, and several members of the parish kicked up lots of dye. Well, Ramsey went in there and tried to mediate with different groups. He approved most of the vicar's changes without getting any legal, always hated law and canon law. He said, right, that's all right. Just stop doing a few things, but most of it's okay. He tried to mediate, but that didn't work. The legal action rolled on. The Chancellor ruled, he mostly backed the vicar and the bishop, but he ruled against three of the major innovations, saying that they were illegal, and what was illegal could not be made legal by the bishop's permission. The case rumbled on for another 8 years, long after Ramsey left the diocese. In these years, an unlooked for happiness comes when he confirms and gives communion to his housebound father shortly before he died. Church and state now haver about whether Ramsey should become the Bishop of London or York. Eden overruled, that's Anthony Eden, who was Prime Minister in the Suez Crisis and keenly interested in the church, as conservative Prime Ministers tend to be, overruled Fisher's recommendation and invites Ramsey to York. Again, an anguished decision to leave Durham, for this is a love marriage between bishop and a diocese, and Ramsey is seen weeping in Durham railway station as he leaves the town. Mr. Kensett had the famous Kensettites lodged. What's happening here? This is the Queen's coronation. The Bishop of Durham always traditionally on the right-hand side of the Queen as her support person. It was felt that Ramsay always looked very good in ecclesiastical costumes. His tall figure, bushy eyebrows and white hair sort of suited it all. This is York Minster. And it was a great pleasure for Ramsay that Eric Norman White is now the Dean of York. He said, "My child, the spirit has become my father and God." His life's now easier because with three suffragan bishops and three archdeacons, he's time to think and write. And he publishes his book, From Gore to Temple. In a way, Ramsay is the inheritor and continuer of much of what they stood for, particularly Gore. Unusual for him. But when he was so nervous with aristocrats, it was unusual that he made a special friend in the diocese of the hereditary lay leader of the Anglo-Catholics in England, the Earl of Halifax at Garraby. And we've come across this man's father, and we were talking about Don Gregory Dix, because his father was the great lay leader of the Anglo-Catholics in the 19th century, who had found a home for the Anglican Benedictines after the great Caldy conversions crisis. And let's remember this man's very important, Edward Wood is his real name, as a political leader. He's the man who was Viceroy of India in the interwar period. He had high office in the Conservative Party. And remember, this is the crucial, when Chamberlain resigns because the situation becomes impossible in 1940, it's a choice between this man and Winston Churchill. This guy had been tarred with the appeasement brush. He did believe in the appeasement process at first, but rapidly saw through Adolf Hitler after the agreement of the Czechoslovakia, and then began to urge that Britain should arm. And many people believe that he should have put, by all political odds, he should have become the Prime Minister in 1940. But he stood aside because he thought that Churchill would make a better war leader.
And there wasn't a precedent then to leave the House of Lords for the Commons either.
It could have been done, but there was another problem. Yes. And he was then sent to America as ambassador to help get the Americans on side about coming into the war. And was also supposed to help Winston Churchill become Prime Minister. He was said of Churchill, he has a mind that works in jerks.
Yes.
So they become very good friends. And Ramsay would have actually preferred Halifax as the war leader. They found plenty of common church interests and then friendship. They had conversations which Ramsay enjoyed enormously about matters political as well as religious. Ramsay went over to Garraby several times for meals or to stay the night and celebrate the Eucharist in the morning. But his father, he stayed in his house, the butler would come with a cup of tea to him in the morning and say, "Tea or Eucharist, sir?" He conducted Halifax's funeral at Kirkby-under-Dale in 1959, and afterwards regarded making friends with Lord Halifax as one of the happinesses of the York years. He becomes a visitor to the Community of the Resurrection Murfield, conducting a visitation every 5 years, interviewing every member of the community, and finally giving them a charge. He'd actually thought about becoming a Murfield in the early part of his career. He shines at the 1958 Lambeth Conference, particularly in chairing the commission on the theme of the conference, the Bible. He receives much criticism, including from Fisher, for attending and giving a masterly address at the Church Union's Eucharistic Congress, which immediately preceded Lambeth, and was thought by some that he might have now written off his chances as a future Archbishop of Canterbury. There's now a growing uneasiness between Ramsay and Fisher. He's uneasy about Fisher's passion for canonical reform. For instance, Ramsay had allowed at Halifax's memorial service in York Minster the use of the 1549 Eucharistic liturgy, which is the one which is Anglo-Catholics love before Cranmer messed things up in 1552. He saw the Eucharistic prayer in half, and it's got an invocation of the Holy Spirit. Now, technically, it was illegal to allow that liturgy to be used in York Minster on a major occasion, but Ramsay cared more about Halifax's preferences and choices than the letter of the law. Well, Fisher stayed away because he felt he couldn't ignore the law. He was getting worried about Ramsay's uneasiness and restraint on the union schemes and his suspicion of the ecumenical movement and his uneasiness about canon law. Now, he recommend, but also he was unhappy about the idea of Anglo-Catholic becoming an Archbishop of Canterbury. Well, it was most unusual for a Prime Minister to have to overrule the choice of the Archbishop of Canterbury, but Harold Macmillan did. He invited Ramsay to meet with him. They both shared a love for the north of England, which Macmillan had come from originally. A large part of Macmillan's private religion had been formed by the Oxford movement. And he said, I thought that we had had enough of Martha, and it was time for St. Mary. So he appoints Donald Coggan to York to balance things up, and Ramsay is enthroned as Archbishop of Canterbury in 1961. In his address, he expresses gratitude and growing longing within the church for a deeper life of prayer. That's Lambeth Palace. And in the weekend, the Ramsays would go to Canterbury itself, and there's a palace right next door to the cathedral, where that be. And the insights about the Ramsay administrative machine, what went on the palace with his helpers, comes mostly from this book, Michael, by his press officer, Michael Delannoy. It was known that he wouldn't be a great administrator, and he did have difficulty about that. And the trouble with the staff was that he didn't tell him clearly what he wanted. Fisher had been very good about that. Kind of let people were supposed to read his mind. He also tended to forget that they had a family life to go home to, and they needed to have holidays. Their life didn't just consist of what they did in his, around his offices, and this could be a bit frustrating for them. In the end, they learned to kind of mature their way around him, and he was served by some able people. But it was a problem. He grows as a television performer. He had a philosophy of what television could do for religion. It ought to be able to show a Christianity is concerned with all of life and not with a particular department of life. Not only by giving an ethical answer, but by bringing onto the human scene something supernatural that alters the perspective of the soul. It ought to be able to show Christianity as something that causes people to think fearlessly and with integrity, and it's not stifling of thought. And he thought there'd be a particular danger in television. The TV interview puts a premium on quick and clever answers, and Christianity can never be understood by being merely clever. Now, I've got a real problem here. A 14-year ministry as Archbishop of Canterbury at a time of great ferment and change, and we could be here all afternoon talking about it, so I must be ruthlessly selective about what I'm going to speak about. So I'm going to talk about his relationships with Eastern Orthodoxy, his visit to Rome, and his relationship with the Roman Catholic Church, about the way in which he handled the honest to God crisis, and finally about the great heartbreak of his ministry, the failure of the Anglican Methodist unity scheme. Let's turn first of all then to Orthodoxy. He first visited Moscow in 1956 and speaks to rapt crowds of believers. He forms a friendship with this man, Patriarch Alexei of Moscow. Remember, the Patriarch of Constantinople is the most prestigious leader of Orthodoxy. The Russian Orthodox Patriarch comes to power because he's got numbers and money behind him. A Tsarist bishop from before the First World War, unpretentious, humorous and considerate about everything about him, an exquisite taste. An old-fashioned aristocratic courtesy attends him. He was a sweet-natured old man with too much experience of the villainy and courage of humanity, and now serene, prayerful, reflective and warm. It was a tense but very real exchange of Russian theologians. He returns as Archbishop of Canterbury to Moscow in 1962. Now there's an official clampdown on religion in the Khrushchev years. Metropolitan Nikolai of Leningrad, Alexei's almost helper, a nimble operator between church and state, and helper of Alexei had fallen, rumoured to be murdered, and he's replaced by this man, Nikodim, the new metropolitan of Leningrad, who Ramsay could not get on with, and whom he suspected of being an agent of the Soviet state. There were tense exchanges with Deputy Prime Minister Mikoyan and Kuryoda of Commissar for Church Affairs. "You're lying, man, you're lying," he said ugly to his face. He told journalists on his return that his encounter with rank atheism had been an ordeal. Alexei notes that Ramsay had praised the Russian Church in his media statements and coming to Lyon in 1964. He avoids all questions about Russia, and there's a serene, erratic presence. Nikodim comes with him and tries to stop comments in the British press about the persecution of the Russian Church, and he's under orders to get rid of Metropolitan Anton Bloom, Russian Orthodoxy, highly respected communicator of Orthodox faith in Britain, man deeply loved, a failed man. There's now a cooling of Anglo-Orthodox relations. because of Ramsay's visit to Rome, and because an Anglican clergyman called Michael Bordeaux comes on the scene, who begins to research intensively into what's going on in church-state relations in Russia. His first book, Opium of the People, calls enough distress to people like Nicodem. His second book, Patriarchs and Prophets, explicitly offered evidence that Nicodem was not only talented, but odious and unscrupulous. He launches the Centre for the Study of Religion and Communism, which Ramsay reluctantly agrees to become its first president of, providing it remains politically neutral, does not accept funding from suspect sources, and is not just on about conducting a witch hunt against persecution, but also records the spiritual renewal of Eastern churches. Now there's extreme coolness from Russian state hierarchs, and Ramsay is not invited to the enthronement of the new patriarch Pima. Now, very curious things happen about this man, Nicodem. Ramsay and Nicodem both attended the funeral of Pope Paul VI in Rome in 1978, and Ramsay got a real twinge of embarrassment about being seated next to him. But Nicodem had come a long way since his early days when Ramsay knew him and had his suspicions. They had managed to keep out of the presidency of the World Council of Churches of Uppsala in 1968, but he was elected 7 years later. He threw himself into the ecumenical movement, and especially into the difficult endeavour to make Rome and Moscow less apart. In Rome at the time of the funeral of the Pope, he knew he was criticised by many in the West as a politicised clergyman and a compromiser. He privately says to a Catholic friend in Rome, who makes the only defence he can of compromise with the Soviet state, "Do not judge our church. You do not know what our bishops and priests have suffered, prison, hunger, torture. When the Russian Church teaches a faith which is not that of the Gospel or the early fathers, then you will be able to condense." He stays on in Rome for the election of the new Pope, and is received by John Paul II in his private library. He comes into the room, he offers the new Pope blessings and best wishes from the Patriarch of Moscow. He sits down in the chair, receives the Pope's thanks, slips off the chair, and dies on the carpet. The room's been poisoned by Russians who are against the rapprochement of Rome. He's only 49 years old. The Vatican knew that many in the West took a low view of him, but their recent experience of him gave them a contrary opinion. They just gave him the benefit of the doubt. This man, Athenagoras, is the Patriarch of Constantinople, a remarkable man who had come to the Lambeth Conference in 1938 representing the Greek Orthodox churches. He'd become Archbishop to North and South America. Most of the Greek Orthodox in the diaspora were in the United States. Their charm and magnetism attacked all which was required to overcome the divisions and Greek Orthodoxy in America. He got on well with Roosevelt and Truman, which probably helped him to be elected as Patriarch of Constantinople. Remember, the Turks controlled the Archbishop's residence at Phana. They've been steadily pushing the Greeks out of living in Istanbul. But the Turks wanted the American settler in the Cold War, so they saw this guy, who was talking about the president, as being helpful. His knowledge of French and English, his acquaintance with the Western world, his openness to international ideas, his range of friendships in the worldwide church, his earlier experience with the senior aspects of Balkan politics, his deep learning in the Greek fathers and some modern writers, it's safe to say that Constantinople has never seen an archbishop like him in the long line of ecumenical patriarchs. Well, Ramsay went to see him in Istanbul, and they became fast friends. Athenagoras came to see Ramsay in London in the 1960s, and their friendship deepened. So out of this friendship comes the Anglican Orthodox Theological Commission, which is produced in the Triune College of the Church, which is a wonderful document for any priest to read before preaching Trinity Sunday. Athenagoras has to cope not just with the difficulty about the Turkish government, but also with the colonel's coup in Greece creates huge problems in the Greek church as they veto certain candidates for patriarchs. This is thought to be one of the high points of Michael Ramsay's ministry, but ironically, he was very opposed to going to Rome. Let's remember that Fisher had gone in the 1950s, been a great success. Why was he not keen go to Rome? He didn't like enthusiastic Romans who tried to proselytize Anglicans. He didn't like the rigid mixed marriage rule. Remember, if you married a Catholic in those days, you had to sign a document promising the kids would be raised as Catholics. He didn't like the rebaptism of converts, which of course says again the baptism was never valid. He feared a backlash from Protestant Anglicans and the communion if he went. So Robert Fisher would go, he was a low churchman. He wouldn't get that kind of flack. But as he as an Anglo-Catholic went, this would be seen as a Catholic plot. But what changes things is that journalists kept expecting him to go, his best advisors kept telling him he should go, the new papal nuncio was friendly, affable, and thought about, and he liked the new pope, Paul VI, who had the same kind of liberal, humane views of things, and who was an intellectual. And, you know, Paul VI has got a bad press in some ways. He was capable of very spontaneous acts of generosity. When the Patriarchal Constantinople's representative had come to Rome, he spontaneously got down and kissed his feet. When he went to visit the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, he knelt to pray. You know, it's a museum now. In order to Turks, he said, well, we're not going to use this as a mosque anymore. So to go to Rome in 1966. So Ian Paisley and four of his co-religionists booked themselves into the same plane. Well, that's dealt with by shunting Ramsay and an entourage up to the first-class compartment. And when Paisley tries to storm into it, a detective stops him. When they get to Rome, Ramsay and entourage are taken off the plane first, but it's kept on the plane. There's time for a drink in a bar, and he goes off to the English college in Rome. Paisley, and one of his co-religionists, is refused entry into Italy by the police. The others go on and try to make trouble, but when they try to disrupt a service that Ramsay's leading in one of the Anglican churches in Rome, they're booed. He receives an enthusiastic reception by the English students at the English college. The famous meeting with the Pope takes place in the Sistine Chapel beneath Michelangelo's painting of the Last Judgment on the 23rd of March 1966, with a private meeting later that day. Ramsay suggests, and it is accepted, that it will be a joint theological commission, which is the beginning of the Archic, which David Moxon now chairs. The Pope gave a little on the rebaptism of converts. Ramsay made a big impression on the people of Rome, who thought he looked like Pope John the 23rd. On the 24th of March, they worshipped together at St. Paul Without the Walls, where it's thought St. Paul was buried. They said the blessing together in Latin. And Paul then spontaneously slipped off his episcopal ring given to him by the city of Milan when he was archbishop there with his emeralds and diamonds, and puts it in Ramsay's palm, and then puts it on his finger, who was then left speechless with emotion. I felt vividly that he was giving me a piece of himself, and he wore it till he died. On that final evening at the English college, he said to the students, let's have an open forum, no punches pulled. And one of the students said, well, what do you consider the most annoying trait shown by English Catholics? To which he said, the natural inferiority complex of any minority group spiced with a certain, one might call it, bumptiousness. On his leaving, they asked for his blessing, and Ramsay threw his Canterbury cap into the air. On Ramsay's death, Cardinal Villebrand said of him, he was one of the great spiritual leaders of the 20th century. His warmth of character, his deep spirituality, and facility for teaching the truths of the faith with simplicity and conviction, all made him an outstanding pastor. Come back to this later on. As the House of Lords, Ramsay's a very effective debater here. These are the years when we have the decriminalisation of homosexual acts, the liberalisation of the divorce laws, a variety of other social measures, which Ramsay speaks and votes in favour of. It gets a lot of flack from tough opponents. I want to talk now about the Anglican Methodist Unity Scheme. All this talk about humanism, all this talk about churches getting together, but nothing was actually happening. Surely the Anglicans and the Methodists could make a go of it, because there's so much in common. Methodists having arisen out of the Anglican Church. And Ramsay had a better chance of making a go of it than Fisher, because as an Anglo-Catholic, he had a reasonable chance of carrying the Anglo-Catholic party with him, who were the most likely to oppose it. Also, he believed the Church of England should be prepared to adopt more self-government and freedom from state influence, which is the chief demand of the Methodists, and institute a general synod, and thought that was worth doing for its own sake. And he felt that it could also be a unique reassurer to Anglo-Catholics that this move would not imperil the Church of England's relationship with Eastern Orthodoxy. So the plan that came up was in two stages. First, constitute an Anglican Church and a Methodist Church which would mutually recognise each other's ministries and sacraments and be in full communion, together with a pledge that after some years of growing together, there'd be an act of formal union. The key point of the first stage was a service of reconciliation. After the service, the bishops would consecrate some Methodists as bishops, and all future Methodist ministers would be ordained by bishops. there'd be no further licences issued for Methodists to have lay celebrations of Holy Communion. This service of reconciliation proposed that Methodist ministers would kneel before the Archbishop of Canterbury and receive a laying on of hands with prayer. The words after each according to his need might, quote, receive the Spirit. Then the Archbishop of Canterbury and Anglican priests would kneel before the Methodist ministers to receive their laying on of hands, and the Methodists would pray the same words for them. This was what Ramsay called the equalisation of ministries. Now the problem is this, that Anglo-Catholics said, okay, if this is Methodist ministers being reordained as an Anglican priest, that's just fine, we love that. Methodist ministers tend to say, well, no, this is a further pastoral opportunity for ministry. The plan now comes under attack from the more extreme wing of the Anglo-Catholics, who say, well, this isn't really reordination, this is a watering down of the whole thing. It comes under attack from conservative evangelicals who say, actually, this is reordination, Methodists shouldn't be asked to do this, and that's wrong. And some three Anglo-Catholic bishops come out in favour. Interestingly, Eric Kemp, who goes on to become the Bishop of Chichester, who turns the Diocese of Chichester into a woman priest-free zone for decades, was actually in favour of the scheme, so it divided along unusual lines. Now, what happened is this, that in 1969, the Methodists voted in favour of it. The Convocation of Canterbury, you had to have a 75% majority in all three houses, voted against carrying the sowing 60%. Well, a real problem here. The General Synod comes into existence in 1970, and Michael Ramsay decides to put it a second time. He's fervently in favour of it. He speaks movingly at all the major meetings, especially the General Synod, when he lists require a miracle to pass it. And again, the Anglicans rejected it. And he experienced this as a crushing blow. He said, well, here's an embarrassing situation. The Methodists have said yes, and we've said no. And he felt that there was a lack of now intellectual integrity in an Anglican decision. At the end of the speech, he quoted from the musical Godspell, Long Live God, Long Live God. The problem he felt was that he felt a loss of enthusiasm for the Church of England. Could he no longer plead that there's been the best of churches? He said to a friend, one of the Mirfield monks, I think the call is to stay and not to despair. So we stay and serve the Lord painfully and joyfully. What has vanished is the idea that being an Anglican is something to be commended to others. It's especially excellent way. Is Ramsay sensing the altar of the Eucharist? He retired in 1974. He loved other people's dogs. He stayed in a house and made friends with the dogs. The dog was likely to receive a letter afterwards from Ramsay addressed to him by name on the envelope. Long silences. People would be interviewed for a job, which is quite absurd, for 30 minutes of total silence, kind of a bit disconcerting. Often this way of ministering to the dying as well. A very restless retirement. He and Joan tried living back in Cudston, at the Theological College. That didn't work. But he was happy here in Ashoda House, which is the extreme Anglo-Catholic college of the Episcopal Church. He would stay for several months a year, giving lectures on systematic theology and spirituality. And in fact, those were published, his book, The Anglican Spirit. He felt very much at home. We love students. Love the young, must have a lucky place to find a home. They went back to Durham and lived near the Cathedral Close until they couldn't climb the hill anymore. Then briefly he stayed at York in the Archbishop of York's residence. This guy, Victor Stock, a very interesting man. This book, young priests, were overawed by Ramsay. They could win his affection. And Stock, as the curate of Pimmer, had kind of written to Ramsay after a visit to the parish, and they formed a friendship after that. He'd go and stay with them in Durham or York for a week a year. And he would greet him with a great kiss on the cheek when he came to visit him. And this book's a fascinating read, but it's diary of his time as the Vicar of St. Mary the Vow in London, where he made a big thing of having dialogues with famous people, prominent people from the pulpit. And he ministered to Ramsay on his deathbed. And finally, he died in an old people's home in Oxford in 1988, surrounded by students from St. Stephen's House, Oxford. The books that have lived on from Ramsay's ministry, Christian Priest Today, addresses given to priests for the ordination, although it's a bit dated in its language, it's addressed only to men, and based off texts like A Band of Brothers Went Forth, this is still being used for profit by many people. His book, Be Still and Know, which he wrote in retirement, a book about prayer and contemplation, sold more than all of his other books together. This man, John Robinson, had been the Dean of Clare College, Cambridge. He was appointed a suffragan bishop of the Diocese of Southwark in the early 1960s, a move in stock with the charismatic bishop. He had first of all made nationwide publicity by testifying in the trial of Lady Chatterley's lover. Remember that there was an attempt to ban Lady Chatterley's lover. He got into the witness box to say what a thoroughly good book this was. That alone got him. And then he writes this book, Honest to God. And it becomes, as I said, everyone has a book that really hits the public mood. For people on the fringes of the church's life, people who weren't going to church but were interested in religious concerns, people struggling with doubt in the church, it just becomes a runaway bestseller. And it's hard to work out why it was. It's a pastiche of what big German theologians like Paul Tillich, in Oxford, were interested in Tillich in the late 60s and 70s, had been saying, and Bultmann. And he said things like, we've got to get rid of our image of God as a grandfatherly figure in the sky. He's inside us. Morality doesn't depend on rules anymore. We sort of make it up according to the situation we're in. It's not a great book. It's a kind of superficial serving up of what these German theologians have been saying. But it hit the mood. And Ramsay, who in many ways might have been the person to respond to this very creatively, kind of jumped on it and tried to reassure Christian believers that about it first of all. And it was felt at first to be unnecessarily unsympathetic. But then he kind of calmed down and was more measured. He created a very tense situation with Mervyn Stockwell. He said, you can't go around disciplining my suffragan bishops and denouncing them in public. Oddly enough, John Robinson was not a great thinker, but he was quite a conservative thinker. He dies in the early 1970s, having returned to academe, having written a very conservative book on dating John's Gospel, more conservative than most New Testament scholars, and left a very moving memoir about his death from cancer. He said, it's as though God is searching me out. The cancer is like the Holy Spirit moving, disintegrating me physically, but kind of making me spiritually. A very traditional and yet also very startling kind of way to look at inside of the world. What I think stands out is not just the theological acumen, which has become a little bit dated towards the end of the time ministry. It was this hunger for holiness, hunger for prayer, this ability to connect with people about that, from whose life he was in many ways different to his own extraordinary lifestyle. In New York one time, a woman came in at the end of a very long day into the sacristy of the church where he was and said, will you please bless this crucifix? He turned to it, gave her his full attention and blessed it. She said, truly you are a child of God. Later on during that visit, a photographer came to the meeting of bishops and said, I don't want to take a photograph of you, will you just please bless me? He just dropped everything and turned and did that. It was this kind of to connect with people. But what he'd given thanks for in his address in Canterbury Cathedral in 1961 about people's growing thirst for prayer, somehow he exemplified all that and represented it. And in the fact that he'd magnanimously been bigger than most Anglo-Catholics about the Anglican Methodist scheme, he was a bigger man than the movement had given him birth. He had seen the breadth of vision and could communicate with people from an utterly different point of view, like Karl Barth, because they agreed about the deep fundamental things.